Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss a new study by Thomas et al. Titled Resistance but Not Endurance Exercise Training Induces Changes in Cerebrovascular Function in Healthy Young Subjects. This article was published September 24th, 2021. Joining me today are guest host Brady Holmer, author Hannah Thomas, and expert Timo Klein. Let's get started. Brady?
Thanks so much for that introduction, Kara. Everyone seems to know that exercise is good for us, whether it's lifting weights, commonly referred to as resistance exercise, or going for a brisk run or a bicycle ride, what we usually refer to as endurance exercise. Not only does exercise strengthen muscles and improve our cardiovascular health, but there are well-known benefits of exercise on the brain. Results from exercise training and cross-sectional studies have shown that exercise reduces the risk of diseases such as stroke, dementia, and other forms of cognitive decline. These benefits are likely due in part to the effects of exercise on the vasculature and specifically cerebral blood flow, also known as CBF. During exercise, blood flow and shear stress both increase, leading to the release of nitric oxide, the dilation of blood vessels, and increased blood flow to our brain. Thus, chronic exercise likely leads to beneficial adaptations to the brain vasculature. However, very few studies have investigated changes to brain blood flow and other measures of cerebrovascular function in response to exercise training using non-invasive imaging techniques of blood flow in the brain. Furthermore, while aerobic exercise has been well studied in terms of its effects on peripheral vascular function, resistance training has received less attention. Aerobic and resistance exercise are associated with distinct changes in blood pressure, cardiac output, and blood flow during exercise, and for this reason, these different exercise modalities may cause unique changes to cerebrovascular physiology. Up until now, no studies have compared resistance and endurance exercise training in terms of their effects on cerebrovascular function. This information is relevant and extremely important to prescribe the optimal type and combination of exercise to benefit brain health in at-risk populations. We now have a bit more understanding of the effects of these exercise modalities on cerebrovascular function and health, thanks to a study recently published in the American Journal of Physiology, Heart and Circulatory Physiology, titled Resistance but Not Endurance Training Induces Changes in Cerebrovascular Function in Healthy Young Subjects. So I'd like to first congratulate first author Hannah Thomas on a fantastically well-written and comprehensive paper. I was very interested, given that I'm an endurance runner myself. I'm always interested when there's a paper out comparing resistance versus endurance training, even though I have a little bit of a bias towards the endurance exercise. And I'm excited to discuss some of the group's findings and the potential applications. So Hannah, thanks again for joining us today. And can you briefly explain what your group's motivation was for this study? But what new data were you hoping to add to the literature?
Thanks for that introduction, Brady. So just sort of adding on what you've just mentioned in your introduction, it is well known that exercise can have beneficial effects on many health outcomes. And one of these outcomes being brain health and the reduced risk of cerebrovascular diseases such as stroke and dementia. But despite this, the overall mechanisms behind these benefits seen with exercise are still not thoroughly understood. And part of this is due to the fact that there's inconsistent findings in the benefits of exercise on cerebral blood flow and cerebrovascular function. So our group's speculation is that part of this inconsistency could be due to the large number of studies using cross-sectional analysis of trained individuals compared to exercise intervention studies, in addition to some other factors such as a range of different population groups and different measurement techniques. So firstly, we wanted to focus on completing an exercise intervention study. And then secondly, we wanted to look at the two distinct types of exercise that have varying adaptive vascular influences to get a comprehensive picture of the effect of the exercise on cerebrovascular function.
That's great. And could you take us through the general study design and describe the participants in this study?
We decided to utilize endurance training, which has been the main focus of most of the research in the literature thus far. And then we also decided to use resistance training, which has a different hemodynamic impact on the vasculature. So we wanted to be able to directly compare participant responses. So we employed a randomized crossover design. Subjects completed either a 3-month endurance or resistance training intervention before moving into a 3-month washout period, and then moving into, again, the alternate 3-month exercise intervention. They were tested before and after each intervention. The subjects were young, healthy individuals, average range of 25 years, and they did not meet the physical activity guidelines of more than 150 minutes per week. They trained 3 times per week and were supervised for every session, and the intensity was matched between each participant.
Reading the paper, I was very impressed with sort of the comprehensiveness of the exercise training interventions. I really liked sort of the progressive nature of them. And in terms of your study outcomes, you all measured an entire suite of sort of measures of cerebrovascular function. Why is cerebrovascular function so important and worth studying in your opinion?
Aging is associated with declines in cerebral blood flow and cerebrovascular function, which leads to increased likelihood of developing many diseases, including reduced cognition, stroke, dementia, and this increasing links to the underlying pathology and Alzheimer's disease. These various diseases have huge economic burden on our healthcare system, and research in both the prevention and cure of these diseases is a current focus of many national funding bodies. There is research to suggest that exercise may be able to slow or even mitigate these detrimental effects of aging on the cerebrovasculature. So therefore, I feel like it's an important area to pursue the possibility of preventing these diseases instead of just treating them once they have developed.
I'm totally with you on that one. And Timo, I'm curious, could you provide us with some clinical significance of some of the cerebrovascular measures used in this study? Have any of them been shown to relate to clinical outcomes or certain types of neurological or cognitive disorders? What's your input on how these relate to certain health outcomes in studies that you're aware of?
So first of all, thank you for having me in this podcast. And I would also like to congratulate Hannah and her team for conducting this really nice study. So in regards to your question, Brady, it has become increasingly apparent that cerebrovascular dysfunction contributes to stroke and dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, as well as other neurodegenerative disorders, such as Parkinson and Huntington's disease. And there is currently evidence that cerebral blood flow and also cerebral blood flow velocity, which have both been measured in the study by Hannah and her team, is lower in adults with dementia and mild cognitive impairment, which is indicative of chronic hypoperfusion. So there was a recent study which prospectively analyzed a cohort of over 4,700 participants in a 7-year follow-up study, and they showed that cerebral hyperperfusion at baseline was related to accelerated cognitive decline and increased risk of dementia. So I think this shows nicely how important cerebral blood flow and cerebrovascular function measures are. So in terms of cerebrovascular function measures, it has also been stated that chronic disease states are associated with vascular dysfunction, and this is in particular observed with a lower cerebrovascular reactivity to carbon dioxide. And a lower cerebrovascular reactivity, which is often referred as an impairment, is observed in patients with diabetes, dementia, and also mild cognitive impairment. And there is a fourth point which we have to add, and this is an impairment in cerebral autoregulation, which is a key assessment of the responsiveness of cerebral blood flow to changes in blood pressure. And this has also been shown to be impaired in patients with stroke and neurodegenerative disease. So I think Hannah and her team, they tried to add a really good value to this study in providing a really significant mix of measures of cerebrovascular function. So they did not only focus on resting flow, for example, but they also investigated the reactivity. And the last point is that they tried to investigate this in intracranial vessels and the middle cerebral artery and the posterior part of the brain. So this has been a really comprehensive measure which they have been applied.
Yes, I definitely think we've now established the importance of all of these measures. And Hannah, I know Timo mentioned a few of the primary outcomes that you all measured in this study, but could you briefly maybe just take us through some of the methods that you used to measure cerebrovascular function in this study, and then why you settled on the particular stimuli used and the particular methodology you used in this study?
Absolutely. So as mentioned by Timo, we aim to get a comprehensive picture of what adaptations were occurring in the cerebrovasculature with the exercise training. So to achieve this, we measured both the intracranial and the extracranial vessels under the different physiological stimuli. We measured the middle and posterior cerebral arteries using transcranial Doppler ultrasound to determine blood velocity, in addition to the internal carotid and vertebral arteries using duplex ultrasound to determine both diameter and velocity, which could give us a valuable measure of blood flow. So in addition to that, we also measured continuously heart rate, blood pressure, and expired gases to determine end tidal CO2. And then to measure cerebrovascular function, we utilized three specific physiological tests. So we recorded 5 minutes of resting baseline in order to analyze spontaneous dynamic autoregulation. And we used cerebral reactivity in response to hypercapnia using inhalation of 6% CO2 gas concentration. And we measured cerebral buffer response to exercise with a stepwise cycling test. The cerebrovascular function is regulated by an array of integrated processes and regulatory mechanisms that work together to maintain optimal oxygen and nutrient delivery. And we aim to measure this complex physiology with the battery of tests that we put together.
Yes, and as I mentioned earlier, that was, I think, one of the major strengths. Not only did you measure sort of resting function, which is important in and of itself, but you measured function in response to these various stimuli, which is obviously important because throughout the day, you know, we're actually engaging in activities and not just sort of, you know, at rest. So that was definitely one of the strengths of the study. And I had a fun time reading the methodology. Our lab is sort of interested in measuring cerebrovascular function and getting into that measure as well. So Hannah, I enjoyed your exercise training interventions, how detailed they were. They had participants gradually progress volume and intensity throughout each 3-month period for both of these exercise regimens. And it was center-based in nature, which was also very interesting. What was it like running such an intensive exercise intervention on such a large amount of participants? Did it teach you anything in general about study design or research in general?
Being a part of such a large and intensive exercise intervention study was a really good experience for me. It was very challenging and time consuming. Myself and my colleague, Chana Marsh, who was the second author on the paper, we attended all of the training sessions over about a 3-year period. I'd say that completing this study gave me a greater understanding of the value of using intervention studies, as well as a greater appreciation of their difficulty and complexity. Something that I specifically learned is that having the face-to-face time with your participants can help to maintain good adherence to the program, especially when using interventions such as this that are so time-consuming, not only for yourself, but also for the participants, in addition to involving quite a long washout period where you have minimal contact with them.
Great. So Hannah, can you take us briefly just through some of the main findings, particularly maybe those that stood out to you from this study?
Yeah, so surprisingly, there were no changes at rest or in response to any of the physiological tests following endurance training, but there were some interesting changes following resistance training. So at rest, we found an increase in mean arterial pressure and a decrease in middle cerebral artery velocity and pulsatility index, which resulted in an increase in middle cerebral artery cerebrovascular resistance. And these changes at rest were also similar to the changes that we saw in response to cerebrovascular reactivity to hypercapnia, but the increases in the vascular resistance were consistent across all the cerebral vessels, not just the middle cerebral. And we also saw an increase in cerebrovascular reactivity in the vascular resistance of the middle cerebral and posterior cerebral. And then similarly, again, we saw increases in mean arterial pressure and vascular resistance across all the cerebral vessels during the exercise response. So sort of overall, resistance training induced changes in intracranial pulsatility index, mean arterial pressure, and cerebrovascular resistance, with these changes being maintained across multiple functional domains.
And regarding the outcomes for resistance training, so again, as you mentioned, surprisingly, reading this paper, I was a bit surprised as well to see at least that endurance training didn't result in any changes. But regarding the resistance training, upon first glance, it might seem like these changes, including the increased reactivity of the middle and posterior cerebral arteries to hypercapnia, increased resistance in the middle cerebral artery, and increased resistance in some of the other measures during exercise, this might seem like a detrimental effect of resistance training, kind of given what we know about cardiovascular physiology. But would you describe these changes as detrimental or perhaps beneficial, or maybe they're just a unique adaptation caused by resistance training? What are your thoughts on that?
So yeah, the changes that we saw with the resistance training intervention were initially quite surprising, and I would not necessarily describe them as either detrimental or beneficial per se. We speculate that the different hemodynamic stimuli experienced during the resistance training when compared to endurance training may have induced these distinct cerebrovascular adaptations. So just to break that down a little bit more, the increase seen in mean arterial pressure is likely a result of the repeated episodic increases experienced during a resistance training bout. So this increase in mean arterial pressure could be interpreted as detrimental, as you mentioned, and certainly is something to consider when resistance training a more at-risk population. However, the adaptations we see in response to this, I would view as being protective mechanisms of the vasculature, and therefore I would view them as a positive adaptation. So we propose that the vasculature has potentially vasoconstricted and reduce the amplitude of the pulsatile waveform in order to protect the downstream microvessels from potential damage due to the increase in mean arterial pressure. So I would summarize that the brain has had a positive vascular adaptation to a potential detrimental hemodynamic change induced by the resistance training.
Yeah, I thought your description of the mechanism or potential mechanisms involved were very thorough and detailed. And then regarding the endurance training, I was also surprised, perhaps as you were, that the endurance training didn't elicit any changes in any of the cerebrovascular measures during the study, even though it did lead to improvements in things like resting heart rate, increasing VO2 max, and then favorably affecting body composition over 3 months. What do you think may have accounted for these changes, or I guess rather a lack thereof?
So I think that studying a young, relatively healthy population group who are unlikely to have impairments in their baseline cerebral blood flow and function is likely the key reason why we saw no changes with endurance training. However, it is interesting, as you mentioned, that we did see improvements in VO2 max, heart rate, lean and fat mass, which we've published previously in other papers. And we also saw changes in central and peripheral vascular function, which we'll hopefully get out soon for people to read. This clearly indicates that the intervention was capable of stimulating adaptation in other variables and even in other vasculature. So it's possible that the brain is such a tightly regulated organ that it's already functioning at optimal levels in this particular population group and therefore sees less adaptation when exposed to an intervention.
Well, now I'm very excited to see that paper hopefully published soon on the central and peripheral vascular function. I'll definitely be waiting for that one. Timo, what is your opinion on the lack of changes in the endurance group? Did these surprise you, given what we know about the beneficial effects of exercise on central and peripheral vascular in structure and function? And then maybe what do you think could be the mechanisms maybe for changes in resistance training and lack of changes with endurance training?
So I think that's a difficult question to answer. It could be related to the stimuli applied. Hannah and her team, they used a continuous exercise bout, and yet we don't really know what types of exercise lead to a maximization of cerebral blood flow outcomes, and hence cerebrovascular adaptation. So a large body of literature actually has been shown that the beneficial effects of acute exercise occur during endurance exercise, and this is on the bicycle. And it has been shown that around 70% of VO2 max, we see a maximization of cerebral blood flow. So following the shear stress theory, it is quite logical that we would have expected a cerebrovascular adaptation, because Hannah and her team, they try to be within that range of optimum cerebral blood flow during these acute exercise bouts. So we need further studies to confirm whether it is important to, for example, use a repetitive stimulus. And this could have happened during the resistance exercise bout. So they did not work continuously during resistance exercise. It could be assumed that they worked repetitively, and therefore that these repeated increases in blood flow during exercise might have led to the beneficial adaptation we see in this study in the brain. I think it also has to be mentioned that there might be different mechanisms in place which occur to structure and function. So Dick Tyson and Danny Green, they have published a study which is already 10 years ago. And it clearly shows that there is, at least in the peripheral vasculature, different adaptation to function and structures within the arteries. So this could also happen in the brain. As Hannah already said, the brain is such a vulnerable place, and maybe adaptation occurs at a different time frame. So a study which looked at training interventions and showed a positive effect on cerebrovascular adaptation. So they looked at cerebrovascular resistance and showed after 6 months of aerobic training that there was a reduction in cerebrovascular resistance. So this was after 6 months, and Hannah and her team looked at 3 months. So it could also be the timing that this might be an issue. So there are multiple factors which lead into this conclusion, and therefore a clear conclusion cannot be drawn.
Thanks for that input, Timo. And I definitely agree that while this study did answer a lot of potential, you know, questions that we have, there certainly are a lot of questions to be answered and investigated in the future. And on that note, Hannah, do you have any future directions in mind for this research or plans to expand on these data or research questions?
Yeah, so there are a number of things to consider for future research directions. Building on what Timo said, I think it would be worth studying the impacts of the different exercise interventions on longer duration in the future. As mentioned, it may allow more time for vascular adaptation to occur. Also, the changes seen with resistance training in mean arterial pressure and cerebrovascular resistance may be exaggerated in other populations, such as older individuals or subjects who are not normotensive. In addition, these population groups may not have the same capacity to adapt to these changes in the protective manner that we may have seen in this study. Therefore, I think future studies should investigate the impacts of resistance training on cerebrovascular adaptation and regulation in these other population groups, but also keeping in mind that it's important to use caution while doing so. And in addition, I think it's also important in future to re-examine the influence of endurance training in individuals who may have compromised cerebrovascular function to determine if endurance training can improve cerebrovascular function in these situations. In addition to this, in this particular study that we've just been speaking about, we will be investigating sex differences seen in the cerebrovascular adaptation, which I think is really important to look at in all studies. And then on top of this, we are looking into individual variation in response to the exercise intervention. So although there may not be many changes on a group level, it can be really important to look at how each individual responds to the exercise stimulus. And if they don't respond to one particular exercise intervention, they may be able to participate in a different type of intervention and get a positive response. So again, I think it's really important to investigate that, not just in cerebrovascular outcome measures, but in all physiological measures.
Yes, and I think the individual response data can be very interesting. Something we hadn't mentioned that sort of maybe hidden a bit within your paper was that this was part of a study investigating twins. So I was very interested to see that. And I think those individual response data, when we see those, will be very interesting. And on the note of sex differences, we would just like to mention that AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology has a new call for papers on considering sex as a biological variable. So this is, you know, an area that the journal is currently interested in, and, you know, physiology researchers in general. So we would just like to put that call out there for papers. And finally, Timo, do you have any final thoughts on the applications of these findings for brain and cardiovascular health, or any thoughts on potential future directions in this field?
Yes, I think one important factor we haven't talked about is that in the endurance group, we saw a significant improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness. So if we look at the literature, there are studies out there, they show that people with a higher cardiorespiratory fitness also show higher cerebral blood flow. And this is particularly important for older adults. So Hannah and her team, they investigated people who have never exercised before or who were under a certain limit of exercise. And I think we should take from this that at least if we did not see the beneficial effects on the brain in the short term, we already saw an improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness, and that we have to further investigate whether longer exercise training durations might also impact the brain there. And the last point is that we also have to be careful with prescribing straight away a resistance exercise in an elderly population with regards to hypertension. So more studies are needed to clearly show what exercise prescription should be used in each group.
I just want to thank both Hannah and Timo for their insights into this paper and a fascinating discussion on cardiovascular physiology. I know that our listeners will enjoy this deep dive into an awesome and very interesting paper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.